What's the most you ever lost on a coin toss?
Llewellyn, what's in the satchel?
Full of money.
I'm looking for Llewellyn Moss.
I don't come back and tell Mother I love her.
Your mother's dead.
Well, then I'll tell her myself.
The crime you see now, it's hard to even take its measure.
Is this guy supposed to be the ultimate badass?
No, I don't think that's how I'd describe him.
Well, how would you describe him?
Well, I guess I'd say he doesn't have a sense of humor.
You going to shoot me?
That depends. Do you see me?
Just how dangerous is he?
Compared to what? The bubonic plague?
Can't stop what's coming. It ain't all waiting on you. That's vanity.
You don't understand.
Did this boy Moss got any notion of the sorts of sons of bitches that are hunting him?
I don't know. He ought to. He's seen the same things I've seen, and it certainly made an impression on me.
Do you have any idea how crazy you are?
You mean the nature of this conversation?
I mean the nature of you.
Call it. You know how this is going to turn out, don't you?
Decided to make you a special project of mine. You ain't going to have to come look for me at all.
Call it.
You don't have to do this.
People always say the same thing.
What do they say?
They say, you don't have to do this. Call it.
No Country for Old Men is a film about a man in kind of a border townish sort of place who finds a briefcase full of money in a crime scene, and he just takes it. And he took the wrong person's money, and a psychopathic killer decides, with a very strange code of ethics, is unleashed on him. And that's the simplest, most like cheesy genre film sounding version of this incredibly complex movie.
Welcome back to Screamatics. I'm Jason Jenkins. Call me Jinx. And today our guests are Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead, the filmmaking duo behind the 2012 horror thriller Resolution and 2014's romantic horror film Spring, both of which are among my favorite films of the last decade. In addition, they are responsible for the short film Bone Storm, which appeared in the third installment of the VHS anthology franchise, and are co-directing and starring in the upcoming film The Endless. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being on the show.
For having us.
Yeah, thanks, man.
Now, I gotta ask, as with every episode of this podcast, I usually start out by asking my guest why of any horror film they chose the one they did. This time around, though, I have to ask, when given the option of choosing any horror film, any at all, you went with No Country for Old Men. And it's an excellent film, but one might be, you know, forgiven for not immediately considering it a genre film. Can you tell us why you elected to pick that film and why you consider it horror?
This is Justin. I am so bad at determining genre, but I can simultaneously, you give me any movie and someone can say, oh, that's not horror, that is horror, I could probably argue either way pretty effectively. And that, you know, ultimately most, or at least we don't make films thinking, hey, we're going to make a film and it's going to land in this genre. We just make a film and we think, hey, we think this idea is interesting. And then we make a whole bunch of choices that to us seem like the best choices that keep the movie continuously interesting. And then ultimately, it hopefully gets picked up by a distributor and they pick a genre for it. So in the case of like No Country for Old Men, if someone said, hey, that's not a horror film, I would say there's almost no possible way you can't say it's a slasher movie in some ways. It's it's a slasher movie. It's just a slasher movie that takes itself very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like to say it's not a slasher movie, you have to qualify it with this statement. No. A slasher movie has to also be...
self-aware or something?
Sort of.
Or fun, like deliberately for fun, like for fun.
Yeah, and in some ways, No Country for Old Men is maybe the only actually scary slasher movie of like the last decade or something like that.
Because I find the inexorable killer to be, you know, I think it's kind of defined as you could put it in the horror genre, mostly defined by Anton Chigurh rather than, you know, say the stolen briefcase of money and stuff. You know, you have a killer that seemingly cannot be stopped. And that to me, when you say it out loud, it sounds cheesier than it is when you execute it in the film. But that to me sounds absolutely terrifying. And what's even scarier to me is that I find this person to be not very supernatural and very realistic in that, well, you know, that guy might just exist, you know, something like that. And if he does, you know, that actually does trigger that part of my brain that makes me scared. And so therefore I would classify it as horror.
Yeah, the biggest difference between Michael Myers and Anton Chigurh is that Chigurh expresses himself more verbally. But other than that, they're very similar characters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're like, all around
and they're evil, and they personify evil, and they feel that way in the movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, one uses a knife, and one uses a cattle killer thing, yeah. And one talks a lot more. But it's very similar idea.
Mm.
So to say one is definitely not a slasher movie and one definitely is, that would be incorrect.
You know, I completely buy that. I don't know that I would have considered No Country for Old Men horror before, you know, you had chosen it for this show, but I think you're completely right. And it's funny, you know, looking at it, I mean, the story is kind of noir in a way. The setting is Western, but yeah, the villain is absolutely a horror film villain. And, you know, I think it's all there in the novel by Cormac McCarthy, too, who writes novels that could be considered horror in their own way. You know, I'm thinking of Child of God or Blood Meridian or The Road or even The Counselor, you know, that Ridley Scott film that he scripted, which is, you know, which is brilliant in its extended cut form. But, you know, none are outright horror tales, and yet they're all absolutely terrifying in their own way with, you know, settings and villains that are sort of as dangerous and scary as any 80s slasher.
It's the best kind of horror is the kind that sneaks up on you, of course, and that one definitely does.
If you took Tommy Lee Jones' monologue that plays in voiceover at the beginning of No Country for Old Men about him just kind of something about, I don't even know the measure of that evil, and talk about that, if you put that monologue at the beginning of the original Halloween, it would actually make, you'd be like, where'd that character go? But yeah. It would make sense entirely thematically and story-wise with the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, he is, you know, you mentioned Michael Myers. He is every bit as, you know, every bit the seemingly unstoppable killing machine that Michael Myers is, or Jason Voorhees is. You know, he doesn't have a mask, but, or, well, or does he? You know, his face is sort of like terrifyingly placid most of the time. You know, it is kind of a mask in a way, and it's only sort of removed when he's grimacing while in action or he's talking to his prey in a confined space. You know, he has that sort of horrible smile or grin on his face when he's enjoying it. But mostly, I mean, his face is as blank as, you know, a white Shatner mask or a plain hockey mask. And I got to ask, though, I mean, how does Chigurh sort of stack up for you guys in the cinematic pantheon of unstoppable killers?
Near number one?
He's probably the scariest because he always feels like he exists in real life. And the filmmaking that is supporting and amplifying his actions, the filmmaking is like, you know, I'll give you an example. There's like almost no music in No Country for Old Men. So when those moments happen, they're that much more unnerving. When those moments happen in Scream, there's a big ass violin sound and all these other things where it's like, oh, that's not real. That might give you a jump in a theater, but it's not really going to get under your skin. You are firmly in a slasher movie universe.
Yeah.
Whereas with No Country for Old Men, it feels like you're watching something that happened or is going to happen.
Yeah. One of my favorite things about, you know, there's the show don't tell rule, and they show a whole lot of just how unstoppable he is. But there is one time where finally they sit down and talk about him. You know, they're in a hospital, and Josh Brolin's been put in the hospital recently by Anton Chigurh. And Woody Harrelson comes in and, you know, kind of tries to convince him to just, I think, hand over the money or something like that. And Josh Brolin says, he won't find me again. I'm not too worried about him. And Woody Harrelson's like, well, it took me about 3 hours. He's like, yeah, but I'm not mobile. He's like, well, maybe he'll just go to Odessa. And Josh Brolin goes dead silent, knowing that he just put his wife in Odessa, you know, like a day ago. His wife went to her mom's place in Odessa. And he's just like, well, why would he go to Odessa? And Woody Harrelson just so casually is just like, to kill your wife. And then, you know, Josh Brolin, so he's still kind of like struggling against this impossible evil, is just like, well, maybe, you know, maybe he should be worried about me. You know, Woody Harrelson's like, he's not. Yeah, and it plays so terrifying, where it's just like, anyone who knows this guy is just like, don't mess with this guy. He's impossible to beat. And like, there's so many like cheesy genre films where it's like, this guy's the ultimate badass. You know, there's no one more badass than this guy. And for some reason, No Country for Old Men, a movie that doesn't even purport to try to be like a genre film, but actually is, has the most, the biggest badass of all.
There's also the thing where the, you know, Tommy Lee Jones' character, the law enforcement official, the one that we kind of basically get to know the most, and he starts and ends the movie, probably the most, one of the most important characters, that he's, he never has a moment where he expresses like hyperventilating, oh my God, I'm so scared. But he has a sort of intellectually deeply rooted fear the whole movie that keeps him from really pursuing this guy. You know, he kind of gets close. There's even that scene where he's like right outside the door and he just doesn't go in.
Yeah.
And he starts and ends the movie by basically saying that, you know, I don't want to really know this.
Yeah. I don't want to live in a world. Yeah. I don't want to know the world where things like that can exist. Yeah.
And you can't blame him, especially when the movie sets up sugar. I mean, in scenes like that, you know, with the Carson character describing, you know, there's even the earlier scene in the boardroom and the floor that is not there, you know, when he is talking to his employer about, you know, how deadly sugar is. I think the line is referring to how lethal he is. And, you know, the Harrelson's response is something along the lines of, compared to what, the bubonic plague. I mean, it's such great McCarthy dialogue, you know, but
Yeah, the actually one thing, kind of going back to what Justin was saying, that I really liked, which, you know, in terms of like, oh, you never really, you don't get the impression that Jones is like doggedly chasing, you know, obsessively chasing this guy, because that's what's so interesting, is that he is keeping it at arm's length. Because I'm thinking of that one scene where you know, they go into it's Llewellyn, right, is the main character's name. They go into his trailer and. And they find out that someone's broken in, and he's like, maybe we should be concerned that that milk still has some chill on it. And, you know, and the other deputy kind of dope, he's like, oh, Sheriff, he was just here. Oh, man. You know, and Tommy Lee Jones just grabs the milk and sits down. I think he drinks some or something. And I like that he's just got this calm of just like, man, do you even want to go down this road?
Yeah. And it's neat that he isn't, I mean, you know, most slasher movies of a sort, they have, you know, what Behind the Mask would call an Ahab. You know, there is typically a Loomis, you know, or somebody pursuing him. And, you know, the slasher, as it were. And, yeah, it is neat that, is it Ed Tom Bell, you know, the Tommy Lee Jones character, he is content to hang back and to maybe not confront it. And ultimately, you know, I think the story that we see in the movie is ultimately kind of what breaks him as a lawman.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of sad, you know. And I gotta ask, you know, if we're talking about Ed Tom Bell for a second, have you ever read the book?
No, I heard he's minimized. Or I'm sorry, no, I heard he's the main character, and Llewellyn is very small, right?
Well, kind of. It's you know, I remember when the movie came out, I had just read the book, and I watched the movie and I loved it, and I didn't really think much about the ending, which isn't what you would call traditional in a sense. And I had many friends who actually despised the ending. They hated that Llewellyn Moss died, you know, before the, you know, even the last act is half over, you know, and the movie sort of shifts the point of view to Ed Tom Bell. And I think a lot of people found that frustrating, or at least people that I knew, and it never really fazed me. And I thought about it later on in the novel. The chapters alternate between what we know as the story from the film, you know, Llewellyn Moss and the found money and Anton Chigurh and, you know, Ed Tom Bell in pursuit. And it alternates with these little 1 to 2 page pieces spoken by a lawman who talks about his long career. And, you know, from the time, you know, one chapter might be from the time he is, you know, he first took up the badge and became a lawman. And then every story after that, just for 1 or 2 pages in between the chapters of the main story, we get this guy reminiscing about different things that happened to him on the job and how it showed him how ugly the world was and, you know, the terrible things that were out there. And at a certain point, when the novel is nearly over, you realize that the person who's been narrating those little chapters is, in fact, Ed Tom Bell. And you realize that the main story is the final story he'll ever tell. It's his final story as a lawman. It's the thing that makes him hang up his guns. And I think the book works really well for that. I think the movie, for cutting all of that out, I mean, we have the narration at the very beginning, but I can see why some people would be frustrated, you know, because in the book, clearly the lead character is Ed Tom Bell. In the movie, it's Llewellyn Moss. You know, he is our hero in the movie, and he goes out so unceremoniously. So, I mean, since you didn't read the book, did you have any issues with the ending before that? Or
I actually kind of thought about that when I rewatched it for this. And I was thinking about, like, and I was actually, because we're deep in post right now on a movie. And so, you know, a lot of your mind goes to editing. And that's, of course, something where it's like, maybe they didn't shoot anything else, but maybe they did. You know, what is the difference there? And here's the thing is, I have a point that I'm going to get to at a certain point, but when you're working on a film, you're doing rough cuts, you show it to your friends, you show it to nonpartisan observers, you get feedback, that kind of thing. And a lot of the times there's a very blurry line to especially viewers knowing they're watching a rough cut between a mistake and a choice. And sometimes choices are viewed as mistakes, or sometimes mistakes are mistakes and you have to weed them out or whatever. But once you put the movie out there and you say, this is the final film, you know, it's premiering in a theater or whatever, all your mistakes become choices. And so anything that can seem like strange or off-putting was a choice that you made as a filmmaker rather than something that you didn't, that was an oversight. And so when I see No Country for Old Men and it has this extremely lopsided, very unconventional ending where they unceremoniously kill our main character, they have actually a pretty cool but kind of beguiling exit for Anton Chigurh, and then the actual last scene of the movie is, you know, just Tommy Lee Jones recounting a dream sequence that is hard to interpret, right? Like, those three things happen in a row. That's, you know, that's clearly something that at a certain point has become a choice, and you have to now just interpret the choice rather than poke at a mistake. And I like to trust the Coen brothers in that I think that that was a very strong decision and probably something that was debated about a whole lot. And so when they, at the moment it happened, I was obviously shocked and taken aback. I didn't know how to feel about it. And then you start thinking about why they did that kind of a thing and you start coming around on it. And I really like it. The point being, you know, yeah, try to fight that kind of awfulness in the world and you will just get run over like a bulldozer, and the film does that, and Anton Chigurh does that to him, and that's why, you know, that's why this is No Country for Old Men. It's a place in which you have to, you know, it's kind of a new world, and then you start realizing, like, that's the whole point of the movie, and the movie has to end with some sort of a thesis statement, and anything else would have been dishonest.
Yeah, it's a super bold choice where they decided to go at the ending. Let me ask you guys something, though. I just remembered something. I can make a strong argument thematically for everything that happens in that bold last act. The one thing, actually, that I'm getting stuck on right now as I think about it is, and correct me if I'm wrong, Josh Brolin, the last we see of him is being tempted to essentially sort of possibly maybe cheat on his wife. But a woman says,
I thought he shows like weird moral, like he immediately says, like, I'm married. Like, I think he just kind of like, it's a light flirt, but then I don't think he's tempted.
I think he didn't give into it.
No, he immediately says I'm married and doesn't give in. Right. Did I miss it?
Or what do you remember?
As I remember it, he does say that what is the line? She invites him to have a beer and he's like, I know what beer leads to. And there is one final moment where she's flirting with him and he gives kind of a smile and we fade out. But I think that there is a hint in that the moment when, you know, there's the shootout that we see at a distance and then Ed Tom Bell comes upon the property. I think Moss is actually in her hotel room. I think she's in the background. So I think it's heavily implied that.
That was my one problem, was that the movie had nothing to do. I can argue everything, the boldness of all of it. But the specifics of him giving into that in that moment, it just, I guess you can throw all of temptation in one category if you want, but I feel like going into, if you want to look at him as a cautionary tale in general, in some ways, that part of the cautionary tale feels way
Yeah, well, let's also swing it back into the slasher thing, where it's like those who cheat, those who have sex, those who have transgressed get killed.
And that's what comes across, unfortunately.
Yeah, that sucks. I didn't notice that at all. I thought he resisted. I thought that was a thing.
No, he was in there.
Because if he wasn't, then it says this evil's unstoppable no matter what. It has its own code of ethics.
Right.
You know,
but
like,
since he gave into that temptation.
Then it has the Judeo-Christian code of ethics.
And since it's a temptation, and it was temptation that got him in the first place,
right?
I suppose that's the point, but it's not as satisfying as if he hadn't given into it.
Damn, yeah, I totally missed that. That makes me sad. Yeah. I thought it was one of those things where it's like he's got really questionable morals, but it's like, but you get them, and that's a lot of the movies. Like everybody has like good and bad morals, especially Chigurh. But you know, he has this thing where he'll steal the money, but he won't cheat on his wife. That's what I was thinking. Like, it's like he'll protect his wife, he'll do anything for his family, but he'll still steal his money. He'll keep it life and limb being threatened, even his family's life and limb being threatened.
Yeah.
You know, he'll kill Anton Chigurh.
Yeah.
You know, like he'll do it, but he's got like other, like, you know, you still think he's a good guy, you know, fighting in a bad world, you know, doing what he must do in a bad world.
Yeah.
That sucks. I didn't pick up on that at all. I feel stupid.
But also, well, taking this conversation further, it in some ways, it makes Chigurh's code more admirable than
his.
Roland's.
Yeah.
Which is a, you know.
Yeah, it's weird. It's like, oh, I have to kill you because I said I would. Although occasionally I'll do the coin toss thing, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, it's strange to think that Llewellyn Moss is not the final girl. He was the promiscuous best friend.
Yeah.
So that would make Tom Bell the final girl? I don't know that I feel comfortable thinking of Tommy Lee Jones as a final girl, but I mean, kind of?
Well, I guess so. I mean, he was never even. Because we can't slide.
I was kidding, but
no. I mean, it's interesting because I would love to find ways to recategorize the movie, but I think that one doesn't work. Just because, I mean, he was never after. You know, they barely even interacted, and you know, emotionally and thematically, yeah, probably. But that's shoehorning. That's probably tail's probably wagging the dog. You know, but he is. You know, he is left in. He is still left in an awful world that he wants no part of, you know, which is, so there is that, you know, there is a death that happens, but it's the death of him being lawman, you know?
Yeah. And I will say that, you know, even though the movie eliminates the brief little bits of Bell recounting his, you know, many adventures as a lawman, for the most part, the movie is very faithful to the book. And I'm glad that they, even if the setup isn't quite there like it is in the book, I appreciate that the movie didn't deviate that much from the source material. And I can imagine like an alternate version of this movie where somebody decided that it would be a good idea to have, I don't know, like Chigurh kidnapping Carly Jean to force Moss into a confrontation, you know, and Sheriff Bell coming to the rescue. You can imagine a really formulaic ending to this movie. And thank God that, you know, I don't know if they had to deal with the studio in making this movie or not, but thank God that the Coens are the ones who made it and that they... you know, they kept true to the novel.
Should we tell our behind the scenes story that's kind of interesting, or is that off the record? I don't know.
Oh, I'm fascinated already.
Oh well, yeah. I mean, it's just you know, we heard a story of you know, the Coens came in to pitch this movie, and I think they sent the script ahead, and someone gave them a whole bunch of notes, you know, and they were just dead silent through the entire notes session. And then at the very end, after, you know, they gave the Coen brothers notes, they were just like, hey guys, I'm really sorry. I just don't think you understand. You think we're making a crime movie and we're actually making a ghost story. And we were just kind of telling you, we're going to go make this movie. So we're just going to go make this movie. That's apparently how it went down, you know, like,
And then it wins an Oscar.
Yeah, yeah, and then it won the Oscar. So,
and how many directors? I mean, what kind of clout do you need to be able to say something like that and get away with it? I mean,
always depends how much money you're asking for.
Yeah, this was $20 million.
I'm not sure.
I think it was 20 or 30, something around there. So, which back in 2006 was probably reasonable for what they were making. I mean, it still is reasonable even today to make a movie like that. It's like $20 million.
Which is crazy. I mean, you know, you look at the movie and it is populated by, well, I mean, you have Josh Brolin in the lead and you have Javier Bardem and Tommy Lee Jones. It is kind of a star-filled cast, even though arguably, I mean, maybe Josh Brolin was just ascending at that point when he took that role. But, you know, even though it is a relatively small story in some ways. I mean, there is a scope to it, and it feels like a big film. And I got to imagine part of that's down to Roger Deakins' photography. But I mean, do you agree with me in that it does feel like a much larger film than it is, say, a story?
It's one of those movies that it's sort of like Sicario, and it like Sicario is essentially an average episode of Miami Vice, but the story itself. it's a brilliant script, but if you tell someone the plot, it's like, oh, that's an episode of Miami Vice. There's not much more else there. But in the music and the direction and Deakins' photography and all of this, it feels like it's about the apocalypse. It feels like it's about, you know, it feels supernatural at how big the stakes feel within this movie, that otherwise the story could just feel like something much smaller. No Country for Old Men's exactly like that, where it's like, oh, you can tell someone the plot. It's just a heist movie. But like, it's in the direction and the score, and in this case, sort of the lack of the score, or the fact that the score is so minimalist, it sounds like spiritual music. It's truly like that is, you know, it's sort of like minimalist. It's literally, what are those bowls called? It's literally that.
I think that's exactly what they used, right?
It's exactly what they used.
I couldn't imagine. I couldn't. But imagine. I don't know if it was a longtime collaborator of the composer or something. But imagine it was the first time to work with the Coen brothers, and he's like, they're like, oh my god, guys, I'm gonna blow you away, and they're like, can you just lick your finger and put it on a wine glass and just do that like four times? That's all I want for this movie. And they're like, really? I could do all this stuff. They're like, no, just the wine glass. I could imagine his sort of disappointment, but he's probably still like, the Coen brothers,
It's funny. A bigger musical setup, an orchestra, whatever, would make the movie feel smaller.
Oh, absolutely.
And another thing, actually, and it's something that we try at least to sort of do in our movies, or you know, especially going forward, but when your movie can have a thematic through line without involving armies clashing, you know, and a lot of the times, you know, if you can have people grappling with something that everybody grapples with in a very large way. Here's a great example of a movie that doesn't feel grand, but does feel important. I watched the One I Love last night, and that's like a great example where it's like, I think that movie is amazing. And I think that, you know, thematically, it's like, oh, it's about relationship trouble and getting through it and being your own person and you know, accepting people or not. But the movie feels like it actually like matters, even though it takes place in a house. You know, No Country for Old Men deals with the inexorability of evil moving throughout the world, no matter how hard people of the light try to fight it. And that's one of many things it's about, but that's probably the biggest one, I would say. And that, because it's so true to that theme, especially the ending, you know, as you said, it's not the, you know, he grabs the wife and Ed comes and saves them. But being true to that theme makes you realize that the movie's about something much, much, much bigger than a guy who finds a briefcase and a person who comes to kill him for it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I am glad that you mentioned the pretty much entire lack of a musical score in the film, because, you know, in thinking about this as a horror film, it is funny to think that horror is generally dependent on the music to build tension. And yet, you know, the lack of music here is what builds tension for this particular story. And, you know, I really appreciate the movie for that, the fact that the music isn't telling us what to think or how to feel, and that we are waiting in suspense to discover whatever intense or terrible thing is about to happen next. And I think in a way that makes it more of a horror film than if it had a musical score, much in the same way that you said, if it had a musical score, a traditional one, then it would likely feel much smaller than what it does now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Our poor sound designer, Yael, is probably getting sick of it, because he's like, what do you want this to sound like? And we're just like, No Country for Old Men. Like, it's just, that's how we always answer.
I you know, and looking at Sugar again, I mean, you mentioned earlier that, you know, much as Michael Myers has like a knife, Sugar has, you know, that weird cattle gun. It's the most unlikely tool for, you know, an assassin to use. The fact that he has to lug around this massive tank.
That and a silenced shotgun, which I think doesn't actually exist. Or if it does, it's still like super loud.
Yeah, he has not one, but two iconic weapons.
Yeah, they're awesome.
The cattle gun is such an interesting lethal weapon to give your antagonist, your monster, for like a few different. Number one is that it is the whole idea of how it functions and how it kills someone. That there is something about killing someone via just turning off their brain that it's just like such a like. It's this really depressing idea of like, it is like the abyss of human thought of like, mm-hmm. Oh, it's turning off a purely intellectual part of a human being very quickly. And it's so meaningless, mm-hmm. You know, it's like stomping on an ant and it's turning off the intellectual part of you without in less than a second. And then that ends you. It ends you via just an intellectual part of you. It's so much more severe than stabbing someone in the heart 10 times, even though it hurts more. It just makes it, it's just like, it makes that person's life, almost everything up to that point, almost kind of a weird, meaningless.
Mm-hmm. And also, yeah. I mean, it's an obvious metaphor, but a cattle gun, killing people like cattle, yeah. You know, like that's meaning, how he sees,
yeah.
I don't think he sees people as cattle, but I do think he sees most of the world as, you know, something that needs his code of ethics applied to it, whatever yeah. It is, his bizarre, like random code of ethics. Like, you know, I remember in the most famous scene in the movie, the coin toss scene, when he's so offended, like he chokes on his peanut when he's like, wait, you married into this gas station? And he's like, well, yeah, that's just how the cards fell. And he's like, so you married into it. You know, and he's like, and that's when he's like, I'm going to kill this guy because he married into a gas station. And it's, what is that code of ethics? But okay, I kind of get it, you know. But I see that as soon as that happened, like right then, I don't think he walked in there planning to kill the guy. But once he found out that he didn't ascribe to his very, very narrow worldview, he went for it. And therefore, like, became one of the masses, became like a cattle to kill with a cattle gun. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's not like a hard metaphor to pluck out of there, but
yeah.
but it is, like, that's how he sees it, you know.
And there's something so cold about those weapons, too, in that they're so silent. It seems impersonal when he kills, you know, not just like, say, a poor motorist with a cattle gun, but even when he attacks the other guys looking for the money in the hotel room. The fact that he walks in and starts spraying them with that silent shotgun. I mean, the blood and the violence of it is kind of horrifying, but I think the thing that's most horrifying is the fact that we don't really hear anything but the grunts of them getting hit with this gun. And it makes it all the more disturbing, I think.
Yeah, and you're right. And that's like the first kill.
And the first kill, yeah, that's what I was about to say.
Where it's just the sound of boots scuffing on the floor, and that's what makes it disturbing, is no one can make a noise. Mm-hmm. Sure doesn't make a noise. He's not passionate about it. He's, you know, kind of grunting. He's like putting strength into it. Mm-hmm. The other guy can't. He's got a fucking chain going through his throat. So, like, yeah. It's like.
And that shot, that face he's making, yeah. And that shot, that would actually have been really tough for me. Like personally, if I had been approaching that film, I'd be like, he's got a silly haircut. He's making pretty silly face.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't know what to do with it. I'd be like, is this going to be haunting and iconic, or is this going to be the goofiest moment to open a movie on? And luckily they did it, you know, and it's great. It's haunting and iconic because he looks completely psychotic. But, you know, somehow his like goofy haircut and that goofy face still works.
Yeah, and even though, I mean, that moment is kind of horrifying when he's strangling him and, you know, the he opens up his neck in the struggle and, you know, blood is spraying everywhere. But I think probably, for me anyway, I think the most chilling shot of all is when he sort of casually walks out and we see all of the scuff marks on the tile floor from that poor officer's boots, you know?
Yeah.
It's just, the Coens, I think, are so great at picking tiny moments like that to illustrate or shine a light on. And that was certainly, I think, the perfect sort of exclamation point to put at the end of that really, really disturbing sequence.
Well, the whole movie does that, that is the movie, like in terms of editing. And I don't know if it was literally editing, like sitting in front of a computer and cutting out other things or editing choices that were made in the script, but, which I'm assuming they were, but you know, another good example of that is, he talks to the chicken farmer and he's just like, hey, can you move those crates out of your truck for me? And then and then it just cuts to him spraying out the back of the truck. And then, you know, and then there's the obvious one of like, he's talking to Llewellyn's wife. What's her name again?
Carla Jean.
Carla Jean. He's talking to Carla Jean and she's pleading with him and they flip the coin. And then it just cuts to him outside the house and he checks his boots, you know, and you know that means he was checking for blood. And it's just like that little action says exactly what happened at the end of the previous scene. And I think there's like two more, but I can't remember them. But there's a lot of like, you just find out what happened later through the actions currently, you know?
I remember a long time ago, I was on an IMDb message board. Don't ask me why. And I saw somebody call No Country for Old Men sort of a litmus test for intelligence in viewers, you know? And I mean, I think there was probably a good deal of snark to their comment, but I think there's a bit of truth to that too. I mean, you know, we aren't inundated with sort of needless exposition, and we're meant to do some work as viewers in the film. And, you know, there are those great moments. There is Sugar checking his boots after stepping out of Carla Jean's house. And, you know, but even some of the, like the smaller, like quiet moments, like, you know, the going back to the gas station scene, you know, Sugar baiting Jean Jones's poor gas station owner with the word friendo. You know, why does he keep saying friendo? You know, and one has to wonder, I mean, has somebody mocked the, you know, I mean, Javier Bardem is Spanish, and even though we don't quite know what, we don't know anything about Sugar's backstory, which is great, but one could imagine somebody mocking at some point the presumably Mexican or Spanish Sugar with that word, possibly. And does he assume that the man before him is the type that would throw that word at him too? I mean, there are so many moments like that where we're not really told what to think, and we can sort of chew on it and talk about it at length later, even if we don't quite know the concrete answer to it. Am I completely silly for thinking that, or?
No, I don't know. I mean, to be honest, there's this part of me that I don't want it to exist in our dimension, but I want to visit another dimension in which there's a really good sequel to No Country for Old Men. And we can talk about all of that. But I don't want it to exist because it'll come out and it'll ruin No Country for Old Men. But I've just got so many little tiny questions that I know would be really, really cool to explore, you know?
Yeah, and I think the best movies are probably the ones that leave you wanting more in a way. I just, did you guys by any chance see the movie that just came out a couple of months ago, Hell or High Water?
Yeah.
The ending to that film, I mean, there's that great confrontation at the end. Spoilers for anyone listening, I'm not going to run too much, but there's a bit of a confrontation between two characters at the end with the sort of promise that they are going to meet up again at some point in the future. And the movie ends perfectly, I think. But my God, how badly did you want to see that final confrontation that they have in their future, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's kind of the dilemma. You know, a lot of the time when you're making the movie is showing, you know, showing too much is obviously like one of your worst nightmares. And that's the question, is where does your movie actually end? Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't, and sometimes you guess wrong.
And, you know, you were talking about Sugar's code. And, you know, to think about it, you know, there is that sort of horrible philosophy that we don't quite know what it is that seems to drive him. But I think that in addition to the weapons and in addition to his face and, you know, the fact that he's so lethal, I think that almost makes him scarier than anything, knowing that you'll stand no better chance at reasoning with him than you would, say, the Terminator. You know, I mean, it's, and I think it is probably no more terrifying than in that moment when Carla Jean, you know, walks in on him at the end and sees him waiting for her. You know, we know that she's never going to make it out of that house. And, you know, that's the one scene that has no violence in it, but I think it's probably the single scariest moment in the film.
Actually, I just realized something, and this is up for debate. I think I just realized that I didn't quite articulate about his code. I think his code is that he really wants to and likes killing people, and I think he finds things to beg the question into that. I don't think he actually has like a real moral code.
He has a, well, it's weird. There's a code. There is a part of his code that's interesting in that at some point he made an agreement to get that money.
It's like, I'm going to do it then.
And he's going to do that no matter what.
Right.
And in that way, there is an admirability to that,
mm-hmm.
even though he's a sociopathic killer, there is an admirability in that part of his code. Is like, oh, he said he's going to go get that money. And even if the people who told him to go get it are like, never mind, we don't want it anymore,
right,
he's still going to get that
right
money, no matter
because
what.
Because I said I would. Yeah, because I said I would.
Whereas Josh Brolin, he waffles on what he's going to do.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, I don't know.
So I think Sugar is just a sadist who uses a sort of false code to justify what he does. Because I, in a way, that would almost make sense. Because, you know, I'm thinking about you know, you think about the weapons that he uses. There is sort of an efficiency to him. He is very, very good at what he does. But there is that moment early on in the film when, you know, he's just driving down a bridge and he rolls down his window and he fires a gun at a bird. You know, and it's like, what the hell is that about? And then, you know, even in that final scene, you know, when he seems to be insisting that, you know, because of his code or because he seems to be merely representing chance that, you know, he has to kill Carla Jean. And she points out to him that, no, he really doesn't, you know, and it's, you know, I'm not going to call that coin. You know, it's not the coin's fault. It's just you. And I don't think he. I wonder if he doesn't actually have a code or whatever code he follows just justifies the murder. I think that's a really interesting idea because, you know, yeah, he says the coin got here the same way I did, but really he just wants to kill her, I think. And
that's it too. I really do. I think again, pulling back out, zooming out back to theme of, you know, if he's just inexorable evil, then in the same way that cancer is evil, in the same way the bubonic plague, as he said, is evil. It's indiscriminate, it's uncaring, and that's it, you know? And I think that's probably, I could be wrong here, but I bet if you ask Cormac McCarthy or the Coens what they think, I think it's someone who would find a way to kill one way or another, even if everyone was obeying his weird moral code, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And he does. I mean, I guess a reading of the movie could say that, you know, he kind of represents death, or, you know, he represents even sort of, what would you say? Like,
well, to every
chance in a way, but yeah.
Well, that's it. And in a sense, it wasn't a coin toss for him that he got to hurt, but it was a coin toss for her, and that it is cruel chance for every single person he comes across.
Right, right.
It's that. It's a coin toss for them, not for him.
Yeah, because he says, like, when he's talking to the aide in the office, and he's just like, are you going to shoot me? And he's like, that depends. Do you see me? You know, and it's like, if you see me, you die. It's like, well, that's a weird moral code. You know, like, you know, I think that's more the, I guess that's really the thrust of it.
And that's another way he's scarier than other slasher movie antagonists, in that it's like, you know, like Jason Voorhees, there's a cause and effect there, where it's like, okay, if you're a teenager having sex, you remind him of the teenagers that neglectfully, there's the reason why he died at the camp, so he's going to kill you. Freddy Krueger, it's like, oh, if he's in your dream, haunting your dream, it's probably because you are some way connected to the parents that burned him to death in his house. With Anton Chico, it's just like, no, you just fucking bad luck.
Yeah.
Like, he walked into your, he was low on gas in that moment, and he went into your gas station, and if he had killed that guy, it was purely bad luck. It was a coin toss. But there is a conversation now with Shakur about predetermination, about, like, I guess you'll never know, but was that always meant to be?
Right.
Was it all those, did a million little things line up for you and him that led him there?
Mm.
But ultimately, it still falls under the category of cruel chance.
Is like, wait, when did The Dark Knight come out?
2008. It would have been 1 year later, I think.
Oh, okay, darn. I was just wondering if we had two, like, amazing chaotic villains in the same year, and like what that says about the zeitgeist right then, you know?
Well, I guess it would have been within the same year. I think No Country came out in late 2007, and The Dark Knight would have been summer of 2008. So we're talking within a half a year.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah, there's something to be said about that. But I just realized he has a lot in common with the Joker in terms of, you know, in terms of the fact that there is no reason, and that's kind of the point, you know?
That would make for the worst buddy comedy ever. Can you imagine those guys just taking the road?
Actually, I think that would make a great buddy comedy. All of that.
It would just be this really existential movie about them driving around shooting people in the face, and then, like, usually not talking about it, and then just keep going, and there's no plot.
Yeah,
and then
it's basically Gus Van Sant's Jerry.
Yeah.
But
people get shot in the face.
But people get shot
every
in the
few
face.
Minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
At some point, they would have to pick up Two-Face so that he and Shiger could just have a coin toss off, you know?
Oh, God. Oh, that's so stupid. I love that. Call it. You call it.
You know, talking about Shiger, though, and the notion of chance, I mean, the universe does kind of bite him back for that at the end. I mean, there's that amazing moment when he gets away with everything. You know, he checks his boots after killing Carla Jean. I mean, I can only imagine. We never see her die, but that has to be what happened, you know. And he gets in his car and he drives away scot-free. He completed every mission he set for himself, he has made it through this movie, you know, pretty much unscathed, or maybe, you know, just a little bit scathed. And then as he's driving through a green light, you know, he should be completely fine. The light's green. He should pass through it with no problem whatsoever. A car slams into him, also purely by chance. And I think that's kind of amazing. That's such a great note to leave that character on.
Yeah, not even evil gets to escape a random chance. Yeah.
But the weird thing, but the also thing about that scene, though, is that even though he's horrifyingly injured, you don't get that he's dead, right? Mm. And there's a moment there where it's – and I kind of left that thinking like, oh, did that humanize him? Or did that make him more of a monster? And like, how the hell did he survive that?
Yeah. You know, I think also think of the other way to take the scene. Yeah. He died in a random car crash. And think about how much that would piss you off, especially after the Llewellyn thing.
Yeah.
You know, so I feel like it's one of those things like, yes, evil prevails, but nobody's chances is just as much of an antagonist as evil, you know.
And car accident was way better than like all of a sudden his 1980s cell phone rings and this doctor saying that he has cancer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like,
the car crash is more exciting.
You know, and the flip side of the sugar does seem to be, you know, Llewellyn Moss. You mentioned a moment ago, whereas Shiger seems to be set and determined at every point, Moss does waffle at times. I mean, it's, you know, in the opening of the movie, he leaves that poor injured, well, I say poor, I mean, injured drug runner in his car to sort of bake in the sun. And he takes the money and he leaves. And then, you know, the thing that damns Llewellyn Moss is an act of kindness. He fills up a jug full of water and goes back.
That's what it was. That was the other code. Yeah. Morally white thing. Yeah. Actually, before I forget it, I wanted to point out something about a really cool comparison that happens in the movie that I didn't pick up on my first few viewings. I only picked up on this most recent one, which is stunningly obvious. But Llewellyn is very badly injured, bleeding, trying to get across the border, and he, you know, asks for the guy's coat, and the guy's like, "I need money for it," and he's like, "I'll give you $500." He gives him $500. And then he says, "And give me that beer too." And the guy's like, "Well, how much you give me?" And he gives him that great look. He's like, "Give him the beer, dude." You know, and that's, you know, that's played for, you know, it's played for comedy, that the beer moment. But also, you know, here this man is clearly badly needing this coat and all of that, in horrible pain. And then and he's our protagonist. And then this antagonist, this unstoppably evil guy, gets in this horrible car accident. And he's just like, and I think, I could be wrong on this, so correct me if I'm wrong, but I think he says, "I'll pay you for your shirt." And the kid says, "No, man, you can just have it."
Yeah.
And it's like, and then so here's this person, you know, morally utterly undeserving of this shirt, whereas the other guy, like, you're just hoping he gets away with it, and they dick him at every turn. Actually, I guess I didn't really have a point for it. But there's a comparison in this movie that I really like.
No, it is. That is very interesting. And it is, you know, the world that I think that McCarthy paints and the Coens sort of translate. I mean, it's a very cruel world. It's a very cold world. And there doesn't seem to be, you know, I wonder if in the world of this film, you know, look, I don't want to get into a conversation about religion or not or anything, but I in the world of this film, it feels like there is no God. You know, I mean, it's a very, would you agree that it's almost a nihilistic point of view in a way, ultimately, even for all of the, you know, Sugar's posturing and his code, as it were, it feels like it all means kind of nothing by the end.
Yeah, I would absolutely say there's no God in this world, in that, like, God, God being someone who will predetermine your life in order for everything to work out easily.
No, even fate, I guess, would be a better way.
So that scales will balance, you know? And I think this movie says scales do not have to balance.
Absolutely.
Like the karmic scale, you know?
Yeah, and can we just talk for a second about how damned well-made the movie is? I mean, some of the set pieces in the film are just incredible. I mean, the hotel sequence, the staging, yeah, and how unbelievably intense it is. You know, we keep drawing parallels to horror films, but I mean, I think that is better than any slasher, you know, stalk sequence that I've seen that I can recall. I mean,
it's incredible. And the fact that it's, you know, the gunfight is silent. You know, there's that great moment where the shotgun is blasting through the glass, and really it's just chipping it away, and that's the only sound that you hear. And it kind of recalled to me like Carpenter's Assault on Precinct 13, that similar sequence where you're not hearing the gunshots, but you're seeing the devastation that the bullets are causing. And it's just such a brilliant way to tell that moment in that story, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
And I love the Coens for that, you know, and the fact that they flirted with horror from time to time, but I think this is absolutely the closest they've ever gotten to the genre. And I got to ask, could you ever imagine them like making a film that's horror with, say, a capital H in a way?
Yeah, I think I totally can, because I feel like they do a lot of crime movies, or, you know, I guess caper movies is a better, when I think of crime, I think of organized crime, but like a caper movie, they've done quite a few of those, and they do farcical comedies.
I could see like if The Exorcist didn't exist, and that script came along, I feel like they would kill that. I feel like they would like make an amazing version of The Exorcist.
Yeah. What's their most recent serious movie? Was it A Serious Man? And which is also kind of a comedy, but.
Possibly. I their last film was Hail Caesar. Before that was, gosh, I can't remember.
That's well, it wasn't A Serious Man, is it? It was probably Amazing, too, and here we are, like, can't remember.
There are so many movies, though. God bless them. They're prolific as can be. Okay, I'm looking this up because I'm going to feel bad if we don't mention it.
Cast listeners are like screaming the name at it right now, like at their phones right now. They're just like, it's fucking this.
Was it Burn After Reading that came directly after No Country for Old Men?
Yeah, but I think A Serious Man came after that.
Then there was A Serious Man, and then something.
That was like 2009 or 10 or something, with that awesome trailer that was to the beat of the guy getting his head crushed against the chalkboard.
Yeah, A Serious Man was amazing. That's the film feels like. I mean, we know that a storm is coming at the very end of the movie, but you were mentioning, like, you know, this film feeling sort of apocalyptic. I feel the same way at the end of A Serious Man.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it feels like the world is about to end. Not merely a tornado, but everything. Everything is just going to go away. Let's see. Yeah. Oh, my God. I
get it. How did we forget it?
Okay, you ready? Okay, from No Country for Old Men on, we have Burn After Reading, A Serious Man. You ready? True Grit.
Okay, yeah.
Inside Llewyn Davis.
Oh, yeah, it was so good.
Yeah, okay. And then from that point on, it was Hail Caesar. So.
Got it, okay. And both True Grit and Raising Arizona also have sort of dark horror elements to them, if you really think about it, especially Raising Arizona. Raising Arizona has, like, an early version of Anton Chigurh, basically.
Oh, totally.
On the motorcycle. But even True Grit does. The other like, antagonist cowboys are, like, pretty creepy and pretty threatening.
Mm-hmm.
You could see how if they chose to do a movie who's, you know, kind of getting away from, like, what makes one movie and what doesn't, if the sole purpose is for just to be actually scary, they could probably pull that off pretty well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know... I think there's a version of True Grit to be made that's entirely from Rooster Cogburn's point of view that probably wouldn't be nearly as interesting as what it is. I mean, but the fact that it is, you know, entirely from the point of view of Mattie Ross, I think the horror is there. The fact that she is discovering this world at such a young age and seeing how horrible and terrible it can be. I mean,
Stop you right there. How the hell do you remember every character's first and last name? I just call them. I just watched No Country for Old Men, and I'm like, the sheriff. The sheriff.
Okay, well, I will admit in the case of True Grit here, I remembered Rooster Cogburn, but Mattie Ross was staring at me from the Wikipedia page, so.
Okay, it makes me feel a little better, but Jesus, okay.
Sorry.
No, it's okay.
But yeah, can I ask, and this is just a weird little aside, but it's something that I've always wanted to talk at length about. I don't know how long, but I mean, I think it's worth bringing up. But there is that moment early on, right before Llewyn Moss leaves to take the jug of water to the poor, thirsty, dying drug runner. And his wife stops him. And there is that line where he tells her to make certain to tell his mother that he loves her if he doesn't come back. And she says, "Your mother's dead." And
it's like, I'll tell him myself. That's a very mysterious moment.
Yeah.
I mean, part of it makes me think that it was just, you know, the first time I saw it, I was like, well, it's a good line. You know, it's a fun line. It's a very McCarthy line in a way. But the way that Brolin plays it, there's that.
It's played way up.
It
looks like he's truly going to die. And also truly oddly confused. It takes him a second to remember.
There's a surprise. Like, oh, yeah, my mother's dead.
It's a choice that people talked about,
right?
And kept it in the edit and talked about before the performance and talked about it during.
And that's the thing is, like, I remember seeing that and thinking, that's the only scripty thing that I really ever thought of when I think of that movie. I was like, it's such a cool, haunting moment. But I feel like he's saying, like, I might not come back and I'm going to go tell my mom in heaven goodbye. And she's like, all right, bye. You know, and it's like, whoa, wait, hang on. But that said, though, I don't want to criticize it because I loved it. So I, like, love that moment.
Yeah, it's great. It's weird. It doesn't feel like it rings entirely true. But at the same time, it is kind of like emotionally, it's a little bit of a gut punch, that moment, too, because we know that, I mean, we obviously know what movie we've sat down to watch when we start it, you know, or when it begins in the theater. And so we know what it means that he's walking out that door. But it always struck me as a bit strange, that moment and that line.
Yeah. Imagine if he played the first line, like, if I don't come back, whatever, with a little bit of a smile towards her, and then the, you know, like, tell my mom I love her, and then he just kind of brushed through after, like, your mom's dead. He's like, oh, I guess I'll tell her myself, and walks out the door.
Because then it's like he was setting up something to be said in a kind of witty, folksy kind of way.
Yeah.
But since she says your mother's dead. And there's like this like pregnant beat and like he has to like remember, and then he's like, oh, and he's like surprised. And then it's just like, okay, what just happened here? Why did he not remember that?
It makes me kind of wonder, you know, cause like if you ask me in that exact moment, like explain that, I'd be like, oh, he's just got a lot on his mind because he's really thinking he's going to have to fight for his life perhaps, you know? Which is also a little strange, just considering where he's going. He's just delivering a jug of water to a guy, but he knows the stakes. But I wonder what that is to him in that moment that's so strong that you say something that implies that you completely forgot your mother died. Like that's huge. Like you wouldn't even say it. You would just say something else. You wouldn't imply that your mother died. You'd
remember it.
Yeah,
you know.
So what is that? And I guess, I don't know, we could chalk it up to it's a movie, or there might be something deeper there that I'm not quite picking up.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. And I you know, I can't say what it is. I have no idea. But I've always wondered how other viewers sort of take that moment in. And if they're, you know, if anyone has a reading on it that allows for there to be some sort of deeper meaning with that moment.
Yeah, I would have, I probably... If I were to cut that movie, I probably would have fought to keep that in just because I like it a lot. I would have just been like, it's a movie and it's cool.
It is a great moment. It is a great line. And Brolin is so great in that moment, and the movie too. I mean, he's, you know, he was always a solid actor, but I think that was the movie that sort of made him an honest to goodness star in a way.
Oh, I just remembered the connection between Sicario and this movie isn't just Deakins. Brolin's in it too.
Yeah.
So put Brolin and Deakins together and you get great and set it in Border Town and you get yourself a really great movie.
That's a hell of a double feature, too. Actually, make it a triple feature and watch The Counselor as well. Have you seen the Ridley Scott film, The Counselor?
I saw it on an airplane. And to be honest, I hope this isn't controversial. I actually didn't think it was very good.
That is not controversial at all, because
I thought it was gonna be like one of those things where it's like you were gonna say, like, you know, it's something everyone says isn't very good, but it actually is. What? And I watched it and I was like, I couldn't. It was one of these things too that you watch as an independent filmmaker where it's like I found it to be like so unbelievably bad. And then like looking at a frame, but I'm looking at like the way the shot's framed up, and for very little reason, there's cheetahs walking around because there's a character who has lots of money and they need to have cheetahs. And it's just like as someone who's like, we make, you know, independent films are very hard to make. We have very small budgets, and you're just looking at that thinking like, man, like this is so bad, but they got cheetahs. They literally have cheetahs.
I will feel bad for admitting that. When I first saw the movie in theaters, I loved Ridley Scott and the fact that Cormac McCarthy was scripting. I mean, I had to see that movie. And when I walked out, I was like, what the hell happened? Like, how did all of that talent result in that movie? But because I'm kind of a completist, of course, I eventually wound up buying the movie on Blu-ray when it hit, like, the bargain bins. And I watched it again in the director's cut. It's only like... Guys, I want to say it's only like 7 minutes longer or 12 minutes longer. Completely different film.
What is with people recutting Ridley Scott's movies to make them worse, and then the director cuts come out and they're always better?
Kingdom apparently. Of Heaven.
Prometheus, Kingdom of Heaven, Blade Runner. Like, why don't people be like, hey guys, just keep the fucking director's cut. Like, just keep the director's cut. Like, clearly, it happens every time, guys. Like, we've got to... He's now, like, you know, probably like approaching 70 or so, and he's just like, guys, I have a track record of the director's cut being better. Please let me do this.
Yeah, you look at all of the stuff that was cut out of Prometheus. I mean, like 75% of my issues with that movie were solved with all of the scenes that are in the deleted scenes section on the damn Blu-ray.
I just don't believe it. I don't believe it, but maybe. I haven't seen it, but everybody says it's better. But with The Counselor, actually, what's really funny is right when it came out, two things happened really fast. One is I think I was just casually browsing Rotten Tomatoes, and I saw this movie called The Counselor. Had never heard of it. And Ridley Scott, like, me and Justin interned at his company when we – that's how we met, you know? And so it's like we love Ridley Scott. And I just – this Ridley Scott movie with, like, Brad Pitt and a billion other people, and it just dropped out of heaven. And you know, and I look up the reviews, and it's not just that the reviews were bad, which they were. They were very bad. But they were all – everybody had a different opinion of why it was bad. And immediately I have a list I keep on my phone of, like, movies I got to watch. And it went on there with a parenthetical of, like, look at those goddamn reviews. Because it's so baffling, like, why it looks – why those reviews are the way they are. They're insane, you know? So yeah, I'm very excited to watch it. I might check it out on Amazon today or something.
The director's cut, I do stand by loving that. I mean, I went from walking out of the movie thinking that it was at best an interesting failure, but certainly a failure. And then watching the director's cut, I adore it. I love it now. And again, there isn't that much footage plugged back in, but it's like everything that they cut out, you know, every cut was fatal, as it were. And yeah, I'm very curious to see what you might think of it.
Yeah. Oh, the cheetah releasing scene, I think, was cut out of it. And that, you know, that would have helped your problem. No, it is a point where, like, a movie's so bad, and then when it just becomes unnecessarily expensive from shot to shot to shot and scene to scene to scene, then it starts to rub me the wrong way.
You gotta get pissed. You gotta get pissed when you're like, oh, when you see that, and you're like, you know that cheetah, we could have made a movie with that the whole cheetah budget.
No, oh, dude, I bet, I guarantee you, the cheetah budget is higher than the budget of Resolution.
Oh, yeah.
I guarantee you.
Guaranteed. Yeah, who calls it a favorite? Yeah, it's a Ridley Scott movie. We really need a cheap cheetah.
Which, sorry, I didn't mean to bring up the the Counselor. It's worth checking out, and you know the McCarthy connection, of course, too. But yeah, sorry, and I feel like I've almost taken up too much of your guys' time. I appreciate your being on. Can I ask on sort of a final parting thought? How do you feel about the final moment with Ed Tom Bell, you know, reciting sort of the two dreams that he had the night before? And what did those dreams mean to you? You know, the first one, Bell talks about dreaming that, you know, he lost money that his father had given him. What does that mean to you guys watching the film?
I'll admit, when the movie ended the very first time I saw it in a little indie movie theater in Tallahassee, I was like, you've got to be kidding me. You know, because it was also like right after Llewellyn died, and you know, and then the movie just kind of like cuts to black on like a weird smile. And at that time in my life, you know, I was much less of accepting of a movie like that, and so I was like, you got to be kidding me. And I just didn't give it much thought. I didn't interpret the dream. I didn't understand it. I didn't get it at all. And so that's, and I only mention that because That was an initial impression. That was the initial impression. You know, that was what came out immediately. And then now that I think about it, I can't really remember how I feel about the first dream because it's very short. But the second one, where I believe his father's made a fire for him and he's gone ahead, right, and he catches up.
Yes.
Is, you know, you can kind of plug and play the archetypes in this movie in terms of the fact that the world has moved on from the good old days, I guess, that you could call that his father at least has presented to him. The world has moved on into a place that's kind of full of impossible evil. And you know, I think he doesn't even reach his father, correct, by the end of the dream.
No.
He says, "Then I woke up," right? There's probably not a whole lot of ways to interpret it, so I'll bet that's a pretty strong contender for one of them. But I get the idea that his father represents this world that he signed up for when he put on the guns, and the fact that he never reaches it is because he's in this world that he's in right now when he's taking them off.
You know, even the first one, I think the notion of losing money that his father had given him, I think that totally plays into it too, the fact that, you know, he's... I just wonder if, you know, because I believe his father was a lawman too. I think there's a line in the movie at some point that he's descended from a line of lawmen. You know, there was his dad and there was his grandfather. And, I wonder if he's sort of lamenting the fact that he sort of failed as a lawman, that he was kind of forced to, you know, hang the guns up and put away the badge, as it were.
Do we ever get the impression that he was a lawman in that he felt like he would, at least on some level, like, fix the world, and if he stopped before he did so, then he's failed? I don't remember that. I don't remember getting that idea from him. I feel like that's me just kind of projecting, but if so, like, I get that then, you know?
No, I wonder if, you know, even before the time that the movie begins, that he's already kind of a broken guy. Like, he's long since put aside any notions he had of being, you know, somebody he might have admired watching, you know, on television as a kid, or the notion of, like, a classic Wild West lawman, you know. And so maybe that's why, you know, whenever he comes close to, you know, not apprehending, but comes close to, you know, being near Chigurh, he sort of backs away. You know, he knows better, as it were. And you're right. I don't think that there's any feeling in the movie that he's the guy who's going to resolve everything, that he's the guy who's going to save the day. He seems much more like a guy who has stuff happen to him. You know, he's not really the film's hero in the sense that he's the guy that we look up to in a way, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 You sympathize with him, but he's not, and we like him. Yeah. You like him, but he's definitely, at the same time, he's not the hero of the story. He doesn't want to be the hero of the story. He's almost entirely reacting, right?
Oh yeah. Totally, yeah.
But oftentimes reacting and he's always reacting, and also he's reacting in a way that is not running, literally not running into the room to help.
Right.
Yeah. Like, he'll go and he'll, you know, but ultimately he doesn't want anything to do with the scene. He feels. Also, the really interesting thing is we can presume the movie takes place like in the 1980s, right?
Yes.
Roughly the 1980s. You know, you start the movie with this old guy kind of talking about how the world's changed, as older people often do. But the more I talk about the movie, the more I think about the movie in terms of, like, the world didn't change. He just realized something. That's something that's always been there, and it's come into town. But the world didn't change. He's just realizing in the end that there's nothing he can do about something that's always been there. And that's another thing about the movie taking place in the 80s, is that it's not about – the movie isn't about – the world's changed and it's become a worse, more dangerous place. I think it's about realizing that the world has always been a dangerous place, and it is.
I definitely want it to be about that too. Because it starts also, you know, it starts on him having kind of this nihilistic, like, thing about the kid who said, "No, I just did it because I wanted to," you know, which definitely backs that up. The only thing against it is his view of his father as living in a different world than he did.
Yeah.
And I think that doesn't change. I think he does feel like his father lived in a different world, and that's why this is now No Country for Old Men. Not that the world is always No Country for Old Men, but it has become one or something. Or maybe he's just entered into a different phase of his life. Maybe that's more what it is.
Yeah. Because it's weird, too. It's especially weird in that, like, the movie probably takes place sometime in the 1980s. And that is a weird time period from, I feel like, even like a populist collective opinion perspective of like when the world changed.
Oh yeah.
You know, it's a weird spot. It's like, oh, you don't think about
the
80s. No one thinks about
the bad old time.
Yeah,
I would say like it's like either post 9/11 or like
the Vietnam.
Or the 1950s.
50s were good.
The 50s. And then we went to Vietnam.
Yeah, that is interesting. I don't think I'd ever considered that before. And it is kind of tough to reconcile that with the title, but I think that is a really cool idea. It makes me look at the movie in a new way, I think. And going back to The Last Dream for a second, I had always considered that the, you know, his father making a fire ahead and waiting for him. And given that, you know, Chigurh at times almost seems to represent death, I'd always assumed that the final dream in a way was Bell sort of, you know, simply accepting his impending mortality. But, you know, I wonder if I'm wrong for that.
I'm not sure if his mortality was on the line almost ever. So I wonder.
Well, I mean, just by nature of the fact that he's, you know, aging, he's retired, you know, he's.
Yeah, I can see it in terms of, you know, because I didn't really see him coming to terms with his mortality in the movie. But I can see how in that moment, you know, coming basically to join his father at the great campfire in the sky, you know, you know, if we wanted to give it that metaphor. I can see where it's kind of like at a certain point, things will continue on. Evil will continue. Chance will continue. And at a certain point, you have to wind it down, you know, whatever that is. I don't know. Am I inserting too much gobbledygook into that? Or is that kind of...
No. I think there is certainly... I love the movie for this, too. I think that the fact that it ends on... you know, a man trying to decipher two dreams that he had and sort of passing that along to the audience to decipher for themselves. I think that they're, I had always sort of read it one way, but I appreciate the fact that it can be read in, you know, I think probably several ways.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a great film for that. It's not just that moment. It's the entire film, really.
Yeah. Well, that's what's good about having like a thematically honest film, you know?
Well, guys, I think that's about our time. Thank you so much for being on the show and for choosing such a great and unexpected film to talk about. Can I ask where can folks find you online and what can they keep an eye out for from you in the future?
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah, we're really active on social media. So you can find us on Twitter. You know, I'm at Aaron Moorhead. He's Justin H. Benson. And then same thing on Instagram and Facebook even. And our next thing.
Yeah, we are in post-production on our new movie that is called The Endless, which should be totally done in the next couple of months, next few months. And you'll have to stay tuned to see where and when the premiere. It's like our last movie, is like Resolution in Spring, where we make it, and then we see what film festival we're lucky enough to premiere in, and then we see what distributor we're lucky enough to get.
Yep.
I can't wait to see what you guys do next. Like I said, if I can fanboy here for a second, I think Resolution and Spring are both brilliant. And to listeners out there checking this out, if you haven't seen them yet, definitely fix that.
So. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks again, guys. And thanks to all you listeners out there. Please be sure to like, subscribe, share, maybe write us in the comments section below or leave us an iTunes review. Check out our YouTube show. If we get enough views, we'll possibly make more someday. Be sure to purchase No Country for Old Men, Resolution, Spring, and VHS Viral using the Amazon links below. And remember, any purchase you make through our Amazon links will help keep this podcast going. So thanks for that. Also, find that Audible deal on our site. If you sign up for a free 30-day trial, you'll get 2 free books. Until next time, gang, thanks so much and have a great weekend.
Will you hold still, please, sir?